From my perspective, Ben, there's just no doubt this is the Chinese century. They know it. I think most people know it. And it's fine if it is. Nobody stays on top forever. But I think it's incumbent upon the U.S. and other Western powers to, you know, get more with the program and devote more resources and be more forward-thinking, etc., or the game will soon be over.
That's Daniel Wagner talking about China vision, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is where we explore all manner and dimensions of risk and uncertainty because I want us all to understand and embrace these concepts to help ourselves, help each other, and help the world at large just a little bit. Today, we talk China, and my guest is someone we have had on the show just a few weeks ago. He's author, speaker, and country risk expert Daniel Wagner. We've had Daniel on the show several times now, but he has a new book coming out. Actually, it's already out. It's timely, it's relevant, and it's called China Vision. This is a book that explains why China is on the precipice of global supremacy, why the Chinese government acts the way it does, and what that all means for the world. We get into all of that. Daniel gives us an overview of China's economy, its vision for the world and where that comes from, its relationship with the United States, its Belt and Road Initiative, and the colonial bent of all of that. China's very different approach to the rule of law and its different approach to the internet, something called the social credit system, how China is very successfully controlling the internet within its borders and what that all means in terms of risk, prospects for conflict between the US and China, cybersecurity, and some of the countervailing trends that are going on in China. The story is nuanced. It isn't all one way. And so we get into that a little bit as well. And a lot more. This was a very interesting conversation. Let's get right into it. Here's Daniel Wagner talking about China vision. The All Things Risk podcast. We're going to stop counting your appearances here because, I don't know, once a quarter, a couple times a year, you come on the show and offer some great insights. So welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure. And the truth is, Ben, that it's good for my health.
Good. It's good for my health as well. It's a wonderful thing to be able to do. Today, we talk China. We talk China Vision, your new book. And I must say, you are one of the most prolific writers I know. So congratulations on another great book. And it continues to amaze me how much good writing you produce. So congratulations.
Well, I appreciate that. But the truth is that this is a book that I've wanted to write for some time, Ben. You know, I'm a political scientist by training and vocation as well. And I actually have, of the five previous books I've written, this is the first that deals with current affairs and international relations solely in the context and in the context of a country. What could be more important in this day and age than China? So for me, it was something that I've really been wanting to do for a long time.
Mm. And it's timely. In the conclusion of the book, you talk about the importance of nuance, and we hear a lot about China from one angle or the other. We don't get into a lot of the stuff that you cover in this book around not just cyber warfare and AI supremacy, but the Belt and Road Initiative, where China's coming from, some of the domestic pressures. There's a whole lot of nuance going on, and it's important to bring that out.
It's important on several levels. One is, if you want to understand China and the Chinese, and of course, that's a lifelong pursuit. Yeah. Many sinologists who devote their lives never accomplish that. But in my modest attempt, you're not going to get too far and accomplish too much by relying on extremist positions in anything, because Chinese history, Chinese culture, the Chinese people, it's all about nuance. It's not about extremism. And, you know, I had written an article some time ago saying that China bashing is a tiresome sport. There's plenty of fodder to China bash if you're from the West or from the U.S. But what I try to do in this book is be balanced in the sense that, yes, there are some negative things that can and should and must be said, but by the same token, there are some good things that are coming out of the China story, and I wanted to be sure and address that as well.
Well, let's start with China Vision, the title, and what that means.
So you'll see on the cover of the book, there is a caricature of Xi Jinping deliberately made to be from the 1960s. This is the way Mao was characterized with cartoons and such. And he's looking through a pair of binoculars, and all he sees in the binocular glass is the Chinese flag. And the book is basically about how I perceive the Chinese government perceives the world and how it goes about accomplishing its aims while also at the same time trying to create a world in its own image. That's basically what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. It covers a huge amount of ground. There's some history around it. So one of the things that comes up time and again in this book is that the West let this happen through relationships it created with China. It allowed this to happen over time. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess a good way to address that theme is to quote Donald Trump, who basically has said that he doesn't blame China for accomplishing some of the unfair trade practices and intellectual property theft that it has accomplished vis-a-vis America and other places. He said he blames the American presidents and the American lawmakers for allowing it to happen. And that's totally legitimate. I thought it was a very useful insight. And I know it's a negotiating tactic for him to put them in the right frame of mind, etc. But at the end of the day, no one has forced any of the world's companies to go to China. The world's companies went to China in search of profit. Most of them believed they couldn't afford not to be there. And they just saw this market of 1.3 or 1.4 billion people, and they said, that's the future, I've got to be there. They ignored so many things, so many prices that have to be paid in order to operate in China today. Mm-hmm. For instance, generating your own foreign exchange, having to sign legal agreements that make sure that any problem that occurs, any legal issue is addressed solely in Chinese courts, and on and on and on. Things they would undoubtedly never consider doing any other place. But because it's China, the government was able to get away with all of this stuff, and these companies were being compliant in the process. And so that's why I say we have ourselves to blame, both on a legislative level and then in terms of business and so many other ways.
I remember when, back in 1997, when Hong Kong became part of China once again, and I was living and working in South Korea at the time, actually, and I can't remember the exact news source I was listening to, but it was an interview with someone from. I think from the UK. It might even have been an interview with Margaret Thatcher at the time, and she was talking about how, well, what's going to happen here, one of the positives of this, of China absorbing Hong Kong, is that this is going to be a bit of a drop in the pond, a ripple effect around, you know, rule of law, democracy, free markets, and so on. And that really hasn't happened. The opposite has happened over time. And I think some of these companies and policies were, perhaps the premise was that, you know, over time, China would liberalize.
Well, China has liberalized in many respects, but the old reference point of, you know, socialism with Chinese characteristics,
right,
and capitalism with Chinese characteristics, I mean, they've been at this, crafting a world in their own image for decades. It sort of only got people's attention in the West in the current decade. And of course, by then it's a little late to try to do much about it. I do give the Chinese a lot of credit where credit is due. They're forward thinking. They get it. They're devoting all this money to AI supremacy, you know, $150 billion by the year 2030. They're devoting all this stuff and doing all these things with vision. That's part of what China Vision is. I mean, literally, China has vision and foresight when it comes to the future. And you could say by the same token, so many other countries do not. So they certainly deserve credit for doing it. I guess the issue in my mind is the tactics and how you get to the finish line.
Right.
And, you know, the way they get to the finish line is a little bit different than many in the West and elsewhere in the world get there.
Right. I suppose, I mean, they have, obviously, they have a very strong vision. And at the same time, however, it's certainly not based on liberal democracy. And you talk about the China worldview being one of a zero-sum game.
Well, that's right. And it goes back to some very basic precepts among the Chinese people. I give the example in the book of the used car market and how there's basically no used car market.
Right.
Because everybody thinks, you know, the person who's selling the car is out to screw them, and the only cars that could possibly be sold are all lemons. But if you use that analogy and you think about how that translates into how the Chinese government might view the world, you never want to do business with somebody that you perceive as giving you too sweet a deal, because there's obviously some catch or problem, or you're going to get screwed in the end. And that's ingrained in the Chinese psyche. So it really translates into some fascinating aspects of how they approach international relations.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating to go back and think about some of our assumptions about China that have been proven wrong. I guess another one would be around its banking sector and state capitalism, and it's so hard to distinguish where the state ends, if it does end at all, and where business entities, private entities begin when dealing with China.
Well, that's exactly right, and nowhere is that better exemplified than in the financial services sector, with the big banks, being state-owned and gobbling up most of the capacity in the lending market, and then that having a knock-on effect with smaller businesses, and where do they get money, and how high is the lending rate, and, you know, the existence of a black market for business loans. But it manifests itself in so many different ways. I think anyone who's going to do business in China has to recognize that there's, you know, layers of the economy, and much of it is driven by the government, but not all of it. But all of it is impacted by the businesses that are driven by the government. And that's, I think, a really important point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is such a different on the surface, it may look similar to entities that Western businesses might deal with. But in practice, it's incredibly different.
Yeah, it couldn't be more different. And unfortunately, too many businesses find out after the fact that the bill of goods they thought they were buying or were sold weren't exactly what they ended up getting. I mean, when I lived and worked in Asia, I was going to China at times on a monthly basis. And I heard all sorts of stories from all sorts of people about things that went wrong. Everything from, you know, getting screwed by your joint venture partner to how easy it is sometimes to get the law to work in the Chinese partner's favor, one of the interesting things really is some of the new laws around cybersecurity and national security, and how they have a national security law that basically says if there's anything related to your business that they deem to be a national security threat, they have the right to basically get the keys to your kingdom. They can demand your source code if that's the business you're in. They can get all sorts of proprietary information. And it's perfectly legal because the law says it is.
You talk about Apple having effectively done that. And I guess it's a bit intoxicating for foreign companies to, you know, with they're breaking into a very large consumer market. They don't want to give that up. So they'll do the government's bidding.
Well, at the end of the day, even the Microsofts and the Apples of the world have to make a decision about are they going in there, and are they going to be forced to play by the Chinese rules like everyone else is. Inevitably, they are and they will. There's the story that I've told in a previous book, my book Virtual Terror on cybersecurity, about how in the 1980s, Bill Gates goes to China and he basically says to them, I'd love for you to use Microsoft and love to be in your marketplace. They'd say, we'd love to have you, but we want you to give us your source code information. And you know what? He gave it to them.
Yeah.
I mean, astonishing, right? That was 30 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was used, right? It was, could you talk a little bit about the reverse engineering and how an intellectual property theft, because I think this features prominently in, you know, this sort of China vision strategy and how China goes about how it all works, because it's very interesting. It's very similar, not actually, it's very different from the Soviet style model in terms of how they might, you know, unpick. You use the spy camera example, but how does that work in practice?
Well, in some places there's a top-down strategy where you would, you know, almost take a product and take it apart and figure out how to remake it from the top down. There's also a bottom-up strategy vis-a-vis the Chinese, and that is, you know, you get the raw materials and you get the blueprints and you make it yourself. That's kind of a crude analogy, but certainly that's what they did with the F-22 Raptor from the United States, and that's how they have their own version of it. Plenty of other things in the airline and aerodynamic and aeronautical arena, which is part of the reason why they did this moon landing, by the way. But further to your point, there are so many different ways that the Chinese obtain the information that they need and want to get the intellectual property to help propel them forward into the next decade and through what I refer to as the Chinese century. And that's everything from, you know, foreign students, they're students who go abroad and end up, you know, feeding information back to people in the business arena, and of course the Office of Personnel Management breach, et cetera. But one of the things that's happening now, and if you've noticed in the recent cyber breaches attributed to China, you know, Marriott, Anthem, et cetera, that what the Chinese appear to be doing is creating a mosaic of information about people of interest to them in the U.S. and other countries in the West. I mean, you may think, oh, why would they be interested in me? But there may be a reason why they're interested in you. They want the Marriott breach is all about, you know, understanding people's travel habits and where they're traveling, and maybe even potentially getting access to their rooms when they travel. Who knows? I mean, prove that that isn't the case. I recently heard a story from a client about this. This guy was a toy company CEO, and he recently had visited China with a new employee of his who had recently graduated from the U.S. National Security Agency. She didn't work for the NSA anymore, but the Chinese knew that she did. And apparently, as soon as she steps off the plane, they seize her laptop and her phone. And I'm pretty sure that she wouldn't have been using a laptop or phone that would contain anything of interest, but I've heard similar stories from other people about how this stuff is confiscated, and of course you never get it back. I mean, if you're traveling not only to places like China, but Russia or Cuba or any number of other places, don't take your regular laptop and your regular phone. If it's not stolen or confiscated, it'll certainly be scrubbed if you're any kind of a person of potential interest to them.
It's fascinating to me that when we talk about things like the internet and, you know, the internet allows for things like transparency and openness, and you know, it's just impossible to control the internet. Well, the Chinese are doing that. They're finding a way to actually, you know, control not just the internet, but everything, people's movements through this social credit system, and it's an amazing project, ambitious and amazing project that's reaping some pretty scary results. Great if we could talk a little bit about all that.
Well, it is indeed, Ben, but you know what? It's scary maybe to someone like you or me or people in the West, but interestingly enough, the Chinese are perfectly content, most of them, with the social credit system. And there's a different way of thinking about information acquisition and personal privacy. The Chinese have gotten used to having the government sort of poking and prodding them and prying into their lives. In the U.S., you know, we'd be getting lawyered up if stuff like that happened. But in China, it's like just another day at the office. But for those who might not be familiar, the social credit system that's being built is basically a system of rewarding and penalizing individual Chinese for their perceived behaviors or crimes, either literal or otherwise. And in short, if you're a good person, by their definition, you have access to, you know, first-class seats on trains and the best schools for your children and all that kind of stuff. And then on the contrary, if you're not deemed to be a good person, by the way they define it, then all the access to that kind of thing is restricted. So it's very Orwellian in its scope. And, you know, if you ask the average Chinese, you know, they may say they don't know much about it or they've never heard of it or whatnot, but pretty well understood that that is a process which is well underway. And yeah, I think the thing that's interesting to note is that from the perspective of people who don't live in China, one of the things that's happening is that the Chinese government is sharing these types of systems with other governments around the world. And as you might have guessed, they wouldn't happen to be the liberal democratic kind, but more the authoritarian dictatorial kind. And so part of what China Vision is all about is enabling, if not ensuring, that other like-minded governments have the ability to do something similar with their own citizens.
Yeah, it is a very scary prospect. And I suppose in China, there's this sort of bargain agreement that, you know, its citizens are going to be given, you know, opportunities for wealth and economic growth. And as long as the government continues to provide for that, then I suppose if you don't have any base around individual freedoms, there's really no need to complain at all.
Well, this is an important point, which is that there's this tacit agreement between the Chinese people and the government that the government will continue to provide a better life for them and their children. And in return, people won't cause trouble and they will be loyal to the Communist Party, etc. But another point that I make in the book is that perhaps 6, maybe 7% of the Chinese population is actually a formal member of the Chinese Communist Party, which means that potentially 93-94% of the people could be a potential adversary of the Communist Party. And I think that certainly factors into how the government thinks. I mean, either, to borrow George W. Bush's phrase, either you're with us or you're with a terrorist. And the question is, who are the terrorists in this case? But I also point out in the book that there are a lot of imagined foreign enemies that the government has created. And there's a section where I talk about, well, exactly who are these enemies and where are they and what actions are they taking against China? My view is that a lot of this is simply manufactured and comes from domestic sources like Xinjiang or Tibet or whatever it might be, so that this, you know, real in some respects or imagined artificial bogeyman can be created, you know, to sort of perpetuate the ability of the Communist Party to remain omnipotent and all-powerful.
Let's come back to that, because I do want to talk about some of the, I guess, the internal threats that the Chinese government and the Communist Party faces. But before we do, I want to talk about China's role in the world a little bit more. You talk about its dual role. I hadn't really appreciated that, you know, China remains a recipient of loans from the likes of the ADB, which boggles my mind. You know, the World Bank, you know, these are loans that are, you know, meant for developing countries. And China plays that card, right, as a friend of developing countries. But at the same time, they've set up their own parallel institutions. Their wealth has grown astronomically. It just doesn't feel like this is a sustainable situation. It doesn't feel like that's the right that's the right answer at the moment.
Well, you wouldn't think it would be sustainable, but in fact, many of the post-war multilateral development banks have existed and continue to thrive because China is still one of the leading, if not their leading recipient nations.
Right.
And you know, there's just an incongruity here that I've pointed out, which it just doesn't sit well with me. You know, I'm a graduate of two former multilateral development banks, both the World Bank and the ADB. And having worked inside these institutions and, you know, been to many of the countries that they lend to, it just occurs to me that there's something that doesn't sit very well with the idea that China, which has lifted, you know, 80 or 90% of its population out of absolute poverty, and it deserves a lot of credit for having done so in recent decades, and, you know, is the second largest economy, soon to be the first, has the largest aggregation of foreign exchange by a mile, you know, 20 times the foreign exchange that the U.S. has, for example. I mean, what are these banks doing lending to China? It makes no sense at all. And of course, it takes valuable resources away, as you say, to the countries that really desperately need it. In addition, the Chinese were instrumental in setting up two new development banks that are actually competing with the other development banks. The new development bank, the BRICS Bank, and the Asian Infrastructure Bank, both of which are based in China, and Beijing was absolutely instrumental in creating both of them. So on one hand, they're competing against those other MDBs. On the other hand, you know, they're continuing to take money on one hand and then lend on the other. So it points to an additional incongruity about China's overall relationship with many countries in the world. On one hand, it's lending money to them. On the other hand, it's acting in some respects like a colonial power, you know, because it's very, very interested, of course, in natural resource extraction. And it's doing all sorts of things in all sorts of places to make sure that it has a long-term, if you will, guaranteed supply of natural resources going forward. Now, you might say, how is that different than anybody else? I mean, doesn't everybody want a guaranteed supply of natural resources? Sure. But not everybody is doing it the way China's doing it. And I talk about, you know, how differently they do this in depending on who the country is and where it is, et cetera. For a desperately poor country, it might provide some very needed and welcome infrastructure lending. For a more developed country, it might look for preferential trading rights. So it does different things in different places, and I suppose it's to be lauded for doing that because that's what's required. But in many of these countries where it's doing a lot of this lending, it's leaving shoddy infrastructure and it's creating a terrible debt trap diplomacy, if you will, debt trap lending that indebts these desperately poor countries with tens of billions of dollars of debt that they know is never going to be repaid. In fact, I maintain in the book that many times the Chinese government lends to these other governments knowing that the money's never going to be repaid.
How much of that is just inexperience on the part of China and its overseas, you know, its FDI initiatives, its foreign direct investment, and the, you know, inexperience on the part of China and its companies that are involved in this stuff, and how much of it is actually just, you know, a genuine attempt at indebting these already highly indebted countries in many cases?
I think part of the way China Vision works is that you get away with whatever you can get away with. And that's in part human nature, and they're certainly not the only country to practice that along the way. I don't really think that most of the time it's a deliberate effort to screw the country. I do think that there are a lot of corners which are cut in the process. I talk in the book about the case of Ecuador, where there is a very much needed hydroelectric dam that was constructed. The problem is it doesn't really work. So Ecuador is saddled with these billions of dollars of debt, and of course, in return for getting paid, China arranged for itself to be able to acquire Ecuadorian oil on a very preferential basis. You know, it's just not even close to what the market rate would be in the global markets. And Ecuador's just stuck. Nobody else is going to lend money to them. This happened at a time when there was a far leftist leader there, and you know, the Western nations were totally turned off by him. And So China, you know, swooped in the moment of need, as it did in Venezuela and lots of other places, and started lending money. Mm-hmm. So it's a really interesting business model.
It is, yeah. And you talk about backlash, not just in the likes of Ecuador, but a couple of other countries you mentioned is Malaysia, where new government Mahathir comes into power, and all of these deals that were signed by the previous government come to the fore, and you know how terrible they were, how much corruption was involved, and in one case, and then you've got Zambia in Africa, how indebted they are to China. And China's pursuing this Belt and Road Initiative. All of this backlash seems to portend that some of what China's trying to do with Belt and Road is not going to go perfectly as planned.
No, and I think they haven't perhaps thought that through, as you alluded earlier. The Belt and Road Initiative is, in my mind, a way of spreading soft power throughout the world. Mm. And Chinese soft power is becoming more and more important. And they're becoming masterful at how they utilize it. But they also, of course, want to recreate the old Silk Road. I also talk in the book about how they're acquiring European ports left and right. Mm. And Europe is the end of the line for the BRI, and they're certainly cognizant of it. I think a lot of this stuff is happening because places like Europe are not really paying attention to what's going on. If they had some sort of effective oversight on any foreign entity, buying up strategic assets in one country after the other, I suspect this wouldn't happen. But the ramifications, potential ramifications, are really serious. I mean, think, for example, about military ship movements from Western countries that go through European ports. Well, the Chinese are owning those ports or have access to that. They have access to a lot of information that might be interesting from a military perspective. Mm. And so, this is one of those potential ramifications that a lot of people haven't thought about. Only one country that I know of that has basically said to China, I'm not interested in the BRI and I'm not interested in any of your money if you were inclined to make me a target, and that's India. Mm-hmm. India has basically said, nope, not going to do that. India perceives actually that it's being surrounded by what's called a string of pearls, mm-hmm. Because China is purchasing ports and building ports throughout Asia, including in ports that surround the Indian Ocean. And, India is feeling very threatened by this. I think it's also worth saying that China... many people don't realize this either, but it actually has the world's largest navy now. It doesn't have the most aircraft carriers, and it doesn't have, the world's largest blue navy with the ability to project its power anywhere in the world, but it's not going to be long before it's there.
Right. Potentially, that becomes a flashpoint if we're thinking about the potential for conflict. And you mentioned the sort of axis between India and Japan, which is the other... I guess, major power in Asia that is threatened by this, by China's rise. It does create some very interesting dynamics.
It's creating some unforeseen alliances.
Yes.
So, as time goes on, more and more countries in Asia and elsewhere are seeing what China vision implies. And there's been a fair amount of backlash. In fact, there are a number of countries in Africa, for example, that no longer want Chinese money.
Right.
They feel they're already too indebted, or they're pushing projects that are vanity projects or that were clearly the result of blatant corruption, et cetera. And in the meantime, these countries, which can't meet a lot of their basic needs to begin with, they're screwing themselves mm-hmm. by having leaders who are sort of rolling over and saying, whatever you're going to give me, I'm happy to take, and not thinking about the consequences in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is a lot of backlash, but at the same time, there seems to be no end to perhaps not entirely true, but there will always be domestic changes in a variety of the countries along this either this string of pearls or in Africa that that China can kind of swoop in as the lender of last resort, right? I don't get the sense from your book that this Belt and Road Initiative and approach is being threatened fundamentally. Perhaps it's being tweaked.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think there are still too many recipient countries out there that need the box of goods that China is selling. Mm-hmm. And that's not really going to change in the future. There's a limited amount of development finance that's available in the world. The demand is outstripping supply. That's been the case for a long time. And in many respects, China's doing some of these countries a great service, because if no one else is going to lend and you still need the infrastructure and your people are still poor, et cetera, then if the money is lent in the right fashion, it's actually a godsend. Mm-hmm. But that, of course, is the problem, that it's not being lent without strings attached. There's always some strings attached.
Right, right. And what you discuss, what China's doing, is it kind of picks and chooses the regimes it will abide by, right? The lack of, when we talk about China vision, the lack of an overarching international vision is absent in terms of institutions, in terms of, other than, you know, it's transactional, it's whatever you can get away with, it's all of these kinds of things. But in terms of a vision based on whether it's rule of law or certainly not human rights, but rule of law, norms, all of the institutions that have been built up over decades after World War II, did you get a sense that China has something that it's trying to roll out to compete with all of that?
I think what's happening, Ben, is that it is creating a de facto alternative order. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that means that the world order as we've known it in the post-World War II era is about to collapse. Mm-hmm. My suggestion in the book is that there will be, if not a competing, a sort of alternative approach to world order that might have less in the way of compliance concerns, less in the way of governance, less in the way of rule of law. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, very consistent with the world that the Chinese government might like to see, because it's accustomed, of course, to being able to do what it wants, where it wants, how it wants, etc. And in the international arena, that's generally not the way things are supposed to work. So I don't think we're going to see a collapse of the existing world order, but we're certainly already seeing a weakening of it. And it's gradually being influenced by, if not replaced by, this alternative order that I'm talking about, which does not really portend some very good things in the longer term. So we've got this world order that includes now this nexus between nationalism and populism and strongmen rulers. And that seems to be growing, not weakening. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you think about this as a pendulum, that you go from liberal democracy to more authoritarian kinds of governments throughout history, and how that's likely to continue to repeat itself in the future, you could say this is just the natural order of things. But I also think that the Chinese government thinks that this is, in a way, a version, if you will, of the American manifest destiny, in the sense that, 150 years ago and hundreds of years prior to that, it was either India or China that was the world's most important and largest economy. And, the U.S. and some of the other Western countries are just sort of the new kids on the block. And the Chinese perceive that they're picking up the mantle where they left off 150 or so years ago. And I think that's legitimate. Mm. Their frame of reference is very, very different, and it is tainted, if you will, but certainly influenced by what they refer to as their century of humiliation, where they were basically berated or, in some cases, invaded by foreign powers with little ability to do anything about it. And they're bound and determined not to let that happen again.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you mentioned in the book around China and the way it conducts warfare. And you talk about this this policy or these tactics known as the Assassin's Mace. I love that. I love these words, right? Assassin's Mace. And what, you know, what that means, and you talk about, well, it's all kinds of things. It's manipulating foreign media, flooding, it says here, flooding enemy countries with drugs, controlling the markets for natural resources, joining international bodies so as to be in a position to bend them to one's will, and engaging in cyber warfare. And you talk about this is a doctrine that was ahead of its time. And you read something like that and you think, well, that's just, you know, that's sinister, and that's, you know, how dare they, that's terrible, etc. At the same time, you know, the United States has done all kinds of things in terms of intervening in states that they didn't, whose governments they didn't see eye to eye with, whether we're talking about Iran or countries in Central America or a country that we just talked about, Ecuador. So what's the difference here?
Well, from the Chinese perspective, there is something called unrestricted warfare, which means do whatever you need to get the job done. And they've applied this in the political and economic and military arenas. So, you know, you might say, well, there's a code of conduct, written or unwritten, that you don't, you know, blatantly steal other people's intellectual property, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But from the Chinese perspective, they're saying, well, why not?
Right. Yeah.
If I can get my hands on it, and if you're dumb enough not to have the right security in place to keep me from getting it, then why shouldn't I? And what they're doing is taking this approach to sort of leapfrog ahead in areas where they are lagging behind. And so whether it's the construction of an aircraft carrier or these, you know, cutting-edge fighter aircraft, et cetera, it would take them a long time to do all this stuff from scratch. But if they can steal the plans, mm-hmm. well, they get it a lot sooner. Mm-hmm. And to Xi's credit, I mean, he's got vision, you know. He's got the long-term future in mind. And, of course, being president for life, you probably should have the long-term future in mind. Yeah. So he actually deserves credit, I think. You know, we in the West, we might criticize the tactics. But from their perspective, it's like, dude, get out of my way. I'm coming through. So mm-hmm. that's sort of how I look at it.
Yeah, that's right. I think they've got the long-term vision, the ability to make those long-term plans. The other advantage is China can make decisions fairly quickly and just get on with it, implement, you know, no sort of debates over human rights and things like that. You know, one of the things that, so it's your book started to scare me when you talk about this, you know, unrestricted warfare, and actually the part where it kind of felt like what you're saying here is that the United States was a bit asleep at the wheel, right? When mm-hmm. their focus in, you know, sort of the first part of the 21st century was around terrorism. All of a sudden, China's, you know, hackers, not all of a sudden, gradually, China's sort of hackers started to launch all these attacks, and they started to build these capabilities. And it just, it seemed like what you're saying here is that we just, you know, in the West, we just didn't pay enough attention.
Well, that's absolutely right. I don't think there's any way around it. And kudos to the Chinese for, you know, being able to, in some respects, run circles around the West and some of the things that they're mm-hmm. doing. You need two parties to be able to do that. So they need a cooperating party to be able to make, you know, what they're happening, what they want to happen. But I do think that the U.S. has been asleep at the wheel in a variety of respects. Let me give you the example of the cyber agreement in 2015 between Presidents Obama and Xi. We knew there was a problem, mm-hmm. and, you know, this was supposed to address it. But there weren't sufficient checks and balances in place to make sure that China wasn't still doing what it's doing and then pay a price if it continued to do it. What I definitely applaud President Trump for is recognizing that the Chinese government doesn't respond well to please and thank you and, oh, geez, would you mind? That doesn't work. They sort of have to be hit in the head by a 2x4. And you know, some people may disagree with Trump's tactics in terms of, you know, this sort of take no prisoners approach with the trade war and the intellectual property theft and all that. But you know what? It's having a result. I suppose it might have had less of a result if the Chinese economy and some Chinese businesses weren't feeling so much pain at this particular juncture. But the fact is they are. And so as a negotiating tactic, I think, you know, Trump has it right. At the end of the day, what is America looking for here? They're looking for a level playing field. They're looking to make things less unequal. They're not looking to have some major advantage that they wouldn't otherwise have. Same story with AI. You know, Trump recently announced a few billion dollars for, you know, a more sustained AI approach on a national level. Well, that's dandy. I'm glad he's doing it. The problem is that while he's doing this, you know, the Chinese are in the middle of this, you know, $150 billion plan that they've got, and they've got a huge head start in implementing that plan. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the U.S. and the West can't do something similar. I think they just really need to marshal their resources and make it a priority, because it is and it's going to stay a priority for China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talk about China's investments in, you know, warfare from space and use of conventional weapons from space, and in addition to AI and cyber, and it's frightening.
Well, think about the landing on the dark side of the moon that occurred a couple of months ago. I mean, that's a great achievement. Nobody else was able to do that. How were the Chinese able to do that? They launched a satellite on the far side of the moon first so that they could communicate, and then they landed this thing. Well, isn't that just, you know, pretty and picture perfect and all that stuff? Well, it's not really necessarily just to say that they've done it and to do something no one else has done. A part of their ambition, and they're not the only ones who are doing this, the U.S. and Russia certainly are, is to, you know, make the next domain the future frontier of warfare in space. And having the capability to do what they just did by this moon landing is certainly a step in that direction, and these other two countries are doing the same thing. You know, there was a time in the 1960s where there was an agreement signed between all the world's nations basically saying, you know, we're going to leave space alone when it comes to warfare. The gloves are off now. That's no longer the case. So whoever's able to marshal the technology and the resources to get there first or have a first mover advantage, I mean, it's going to be a new ballgame. They know it.
Yeah, and all of this part of the book was, as I mentioned, quite frightening, because it is a version of the future that doesn't really sit well with, I think, a lot of us in the West. When you compare and contrast the European approach, for example, to data and China's approach to data, right? So in Europe, we've got this general data protection regulation, GDPR, and it's all about, you know, the individual owns their data. In China, it's the complete opposite. The state owns, you know, everything. And so China is building all of the infrastructure and technology to be able to control all of the, you know, all of the internet within its borders. That certainly doesn't sit well, I think, with a lot of people in the West. Could we talk a little bit about perhaps some of the, so that's one vision of the future. Could we talk about perhaps some of the countervailing forces? Because I think there are a few things, and this is a book about nuance, so there are a few things that you touch on. One was this sort of internal social pressure in the country. You know, the citizens' demands, you know, things like clean air, and I don't know if this is still the case, but up to several years ago, a number of localized protests around, particularly, you know, corruption and environmental conditions. You talk about 94% of the populace in China is not a member of the Communist Party. So what are some of the countervailing forces, perhaps from within, where cracks might emerge in China?
So one of the things that most people will be aware has happened is that the Chinese middle class has ballooned, particularly in the current decade. Anywhere you go in the world, literally any corner of the world, you're going to see Chinese tourists or business people there, et cetera. And that's fine. That's great. But what's happening as a result, with more and more Chinese experiencing more and more of the world and, you know, having friends from around the world, et cetera, is that they're coming to demand more from their government than they previously demanded. And they're more sophisticated. So it's not just about, yes, of course, I want a better life than my parents had, and I expect my children to have a better life than I've had, and I'm going to sort of rely on you, Chinese government, to provide that for me. They're also saying, yeah, but I want my quality of life in terms of the air I breathe and the food I eat and the drugs that I take, et cetera, to be of better quality. I want it to be international standards. I'd like not to have to worry about these things, just like people in many other countries in the world are able not to have to worry about whether their food is safe to eat and their water is safe to drink, et cetera. But if you take that mindset and you expand it a little bit, you'll see that the challenge for the Chinese government then as a result is far broader than what it was just a few years ago. It's no longer the case that, you know, you can easily identify the potential bad actors and you can do something about it. There are potentially too many tens or hundreds of millions of them in Chinese society to do that. That's part of the reason they're creating the social credit system. But what I see evolving is a sort of a give and take, where the government is recognizing that it's going to have to do some things differently, and the people are recognizing that they can, you know, gradually continue to demand more of their government. There'll be a bit of a give and take, and they'll arrive at some sort of an equilibrium. I think they're sort of feeling each other out at the moment.
Mm-hmm. When the Asian financial crisis happened in 97, 98, it took a lot of the investment community by surprise. And because these were all sort of emerging tigers and all of these kinds of things, and all of a sudden a lot of the hot money realized, well, there are huge corruption and governance problems in a number of these countries, and so that precipitated this sort of collapse of all these currencies. What about China's banking system and banking pressures? You talk about the amount of inflation that there is in the system, and also that smaller companies aren't able to get access to credit. And what is your view on that? Not just that, but also the veracity of the numbers coming out of China.
Well, China's a unique entity in the sense that every time the economists are predicting a hard left landing or a soft landing, there's usually no landing at all, because the government is so talented at manipulating various aspects of the economy and having control over the banking system, et cetera. So you do have to give the Chinese government credit for keeping the plates spinning, you know, for keeping all the plates spinning for so long, and, you know, having the ability to presumably continue to do that. In many other countries, you know, the plates would have come crashing down a long time ago. There will be presumably an end of the road where all of that is concerned, where the plates no longer keep spinning. But every time somebody attempts to predict when, how, or if that's going to occur, they're inevitably wrong. So I'm not brave enough to go into that business on this podcast, right, or in the book. But what I would say is that the government's task in a variety of areas is becoming more challenging. And they have the advantage of having a lot of Chinese who might ordinarily have gotten a Western education and stayed in the West or outside of China come back to China and bring their education and their talent with them. And part of the reason why they've been able to keep the plates spinning for as long as they have is just that. You know, they're with the program, they're cutting edge, they get it, and they're able to anticipate things that many other governments might not anticipate. I'll use the example of AI again. You know, you take a country like Australia, which has devoted, I don't know, less than $10 million or something in the current budget to developing AI. You know, what is that? And I'm not trying to pick on Australia. I'm just saying that there are, you go country after country after country, and they just don't get it. And I think the Chinese government deserves a lot of credit for getting a lot of things right in that regard, or those plates would have come crashing down a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this, the Thucydides trap. As a student of international relations, I know about this, but as China grows and as the United States tries to maintain its preeminence, basically, I think what this is saying is that in most cases where this happens historically, you get into warfare. What is your view on the potential for conflict, overt, violent military conflict between China and the U.S.?
So the Thucydides trap, for those who may not be familiar, is the idea that, you know, the existing power eventually weakens and the rising power, you know, rises sufficiently to challenge the existing power. And it's the idea that warfare is inevitable on that basis. I don't think warfare is inevitable between China and the U.S. I think the stakes are simply too high for both parties. And part of the reason why this trade dispute is ultimately going to be resolved peaceably and presumably amicably is because they realize this. They're sort of stuck in this marriage, and nobody's going anywhere, and nobody's getting divorced, and they need each other. So they're going to find a way to make it work. I do think that there will come a time when China has that blue water navy and has advanced in other areas militarily, which will theoretically enable it to seriously challenge the power of the U.S., but I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Right.
And, you know, if Mr. Trump stays in power and keeps feeding the U.S. military as he is and, you know, getting on the right side of things with, you know, cyber and AI, et cetera, you know, I think it's going to buy the U.S. a lot of time. Mm-hmm. But from my perspective, Ben, there's just no doubt this is the Chinese century. They know it. I think most people know it. And it's fine if it is. Nobody stays on top forever. But I think it's incumbent upon the U.S. and other Western powers to, you know, get more with the program and devote more resources and be more forward-thinking, et cetera, or the game will soon be over.
Hmm. How do you wish that pundits and all of us started to talk about, and policymakers as well, started to talk about China going forward? What do you hope will arise over the coming years, and hopefully partially as a result of your book?
Well, wouldn't it be nice if it had an impact that way? But I do think that, first of all, it's on everybody's mind, and it's not going to stop being on everybody's mind. It's a hot topic. It's going to stay that way. Mm-hmm. Great. I would like to believe that there's going to be a deeper, more meaningful analysis on the part of a lot of tacticians, government folks, think tanks, about, you know, what China really is and what's really at stake here, because that's ultimately what this book is about. I'm wanting for people around the world to think more seriously about some of the broader impacts of what's happening with China. And, of course, for the Chinese people as well. I'm not shy about saying that I wish they had the sort of government that was more responsive to their needs and that treated them better. But that's really not the purpose of the book. The focus is, of course, on international relations. I do think that if there is some sustained effort on the part of a bunch of Western nations to perhaps, I don't know, if it would be share intelligence or strategize together with some greater frequency about what they intend to do collectively about this rising China, I think that could make a difference. But by the same token, there are so many aspects of the international order that no longer work particularly well, that are no longer in sync. You know, the idea, for example, of having, you know, the five major powers, the five great powers from World War II who are still sort of running the show at the UN Security Council. I mean, what is that? And I think by the same token, the multilateral development banks, they need to be modernized and reformed. And I think in some sense, China can be a driver for that
right.
stuff.
And democracy needs to be reformed, right?
Absolutely.
We're operating under all these really old, archaic ways of doing things, both in the US, here in the UK and Canada, these systems that were built 300, 400, 500 years ago that don't serve our needs.
That's exactly right. They don't. And I think we would be wise to acknowledge that they don't. And we would be wise, I think, also to get out in front of the efforts to reform them. I use the example of the World Bank and how the new U.S. nominee, Mr. Malpass, is likely to shake things up, presuming he gets in, and I'm pretty sure he will. Mm-hmm. look, it doesn't matter to me where the initiative comes from. If it can result in the way these institutions do things a little bit differently, I'm all for it.
Right. We covered a lot of ground. Actually, I had another question before we start to wrap it up, but and that was just simply 6 months down the road, if you were to, well, I'm not sure you would be interested in traveling to China. What do you think would happen, though, if you tried to travel to China?
I'm fond of saying to friends and family that I don't think I'm important enough to matter.
Okay.
But by the same token, there are lots of ordinary people who, you know, get caught up in things that they didn't anticipate. I've been told by more than one Chinese person that it's one thing for a Chinese person to criticize the government, right? They're probably going to be harshly penalized for that. I think it's something else for constructive criticism to come from a foreign source. I'm told that the book of Mr. Trump's primary Chinese advisor is banned in China, but that all the Chinese government people are reading it. So,
right. Okay.
I mean, I would be delighted if the same thing happened with this book, because I think it's important for them to understand that at least some people in the West are thinking about this stuff. And you know, my objective is not to trash the government. My objective is to encourage constructive criticism and reform, so that you know, everybody gets their needs met, and that maybe the government will consider changing the way it does some things.
I think that's a very noble aspiration. We covered a lot of ground. Did you want to mention anything that we didn't get a chance to cover?
I would simply say that this is an intellectually honest book. As you can tell from the way we're having our discussion, I don't really hold much back. I think it's important, if you're going to embark on a book like this, to be intellectually honest. But it's based on my experience since 1986 going to China, and some of the things that I've learned, some of the stories I've got to tell. And the reviews have been really good from some think tank folks and some others. So I'm hoping for a little good reception.
Yeah, it's a very, certainly it's a timely book, but it's a very useful book, particularly for those that, you know, really want to get up to speed with what's going on. It's hard to find that nuanced description of some of these things that, you know, that things that that are written about China that don't come with some sort of baggage. So what was it like to pull it together? Was there anything that surprised you in the course of writing this? That
not so much, because I had done a fair amount of research over the years on a lot of these topics and written about it. But I think what made writing this book easier than some of the other books that I've written is the sheer wealth of material out there. The information is just overwhelming. I think it's a challenge to sort of wade through it and figure out what's worth paying attention to and what's worth putting in the book. For people who are interested in learning more about China, I mean, this is an excellent time to be doing that. So, and of course, if you've never been there, please go see it. It's an amazing place.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I think we covered a lot of ground here, and I think we ought to wrap things up. But before we do, where can people find China Vision and learn more about you and all that good stuff?
China Vision is out in the third week of February 2019, and it's being published by Amazon. So you can get both the print and the Kindle version on Amazon, and the audio version will follow in the coming weeks.
Awesome. Thank you, Daniel. This was great. As usual, it was, I always learn a lot, and you know, I just hope you keep it up at this. But it's a blistering pace, so I can imagine. But well done on the book and yet another book. And
I appreciate that, Ben. It's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, folks. I hope you enjoyed that. I always learn tons when I have Daniel on the show and I speak to him. Check out China Vision. Check out Daniel. Links are in the show notes as usual. And of course, subscribe to All Things Risk. We've got a number of interesting things coming up. go to allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, subscribe to the podcast, but also subscribe to our newsletter and get updates on some upcoming things, including some courses and a few other events that we are planning over the course of 2019. That is it. We will be back in 2 weeks with our next full episode. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.